Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Human Performance Outliers podcast with Zach Bitter. All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Human Performance Outliers podcast. I'm your host, Zach Bitter, and I want to welcome everyone to this episode of the show. As a way to thank the listeners for helping me grow this podcast over the years, I'm going to continue a raffle option for all of you to have a chance to win a free consultation with me. So it's a 30-minute consultation that I will raffle off once per month. All you have to do to enter is share the episodes that you enjoy on whatever platform you find most interesting. The only thing I ask you to do is, if it's a social media channel, make sure you tag me so I see it and can save that and enter you in the raffle. Or if it's somewhere else that you can't tag me at, take a screenshot and send that to me at hpopodcast@gmail.com. You can also enter the raffle by writing a show review on your favorite podcast listening platform. So if you do that, take the screenshot, send it to hpopodcast@gmail.com, and I will enter you in that monthly raffle. Also, I'm excited to announce that I launched a new group coaching option. So to go along with my personalized one-on-one coaching options and my pre-made plans that I have on my website at zachbitter.com, this year I'm starting a group of online endurance runners who want to work with me in a slightly different model. So this model is set up so that whether you're a beginner or advanced, you can join. Whether you're training for something like a 5K or something as far as a 200 plus miler, you are welcome, and this setup will help you reach your goals. The way I have it set up is, if you subscribe, you will have access to my full catalog of training plans, which range from beginner 5K all the way up to advanced 200 plus miles. Along with that plan that you're going to use, you will have access to a weekly group meeting where you can ask questions about training, you can ask about adjustments to the plan to make it more personalized to you, you can engage with the other group members if you want. We'll get you all set up and ready to really personalize that plan to make sure that you're heading in the right direction for your event. Also, you will have access to office hours, where if you have something you want to ask and you want to just hop in and ask a question, you'll be given access to that as well. I will be bringing in guest speakers who have a deep understanding of specific topics and things that we'll use to better your training and recovery process throughout the course of the year, as well as a private forum for all the members to engage with one another, share stories, share training tips, and just house a lot of the information that we'll go over on the daily and weekly basis as you're pursuing your race goals. So if you're interested in checking that out, just head to my website at zachbitter.com, go to the coaching tab. From there, you'll be directed to the team coaching option, and you can sign up for that and get onboarded to join the group. If you're interested in keeping up with what I'm up to, please give me a follow on some of my socials. Follow me on Instagram at Zach Bitter, on X, Twitter at ZBitter, and check out the brand new HPO podcast handles, which are just at HPO podcast on Instagram and X/Twitter. Of course, all this stuff can be found quite easily on my website, which is the main landing page for everything I do at zachbitter.com. Here are some discounts and promos for the HPO sponsors. I have a full breakdown of how I use each of these products at the end of every episode. S-Fuels has a 15% site-wide discount and right now are running a free 30-serving pack of their S-Fuels Train product with promo code HPOTRAIN. Hurry up on this one, though. They have a limited number of supplies. Go to sfuelsgolonger.com, promo code HPOTRAIN. John G. Apparel has 10% off with promo code BITTER10. Check out their AFO shorts if you're in the market for a new pair of running or gym shorts. That's johnji.com, J-A-N-J-I.com. Element Electrolytes has a free sample pack with purchase and satisfaction guarantee, meaning if you don't like it, they will give you your money back, no questions asked, and you don't even have to return the box. Go to drinklmnt.com/HPO to get that free sample pack and try out all their flavors with your purchase. Finally, Delta G Ketones has 20% off with BITTER20 promo code, and they also offer free consultations to help you assess how their product would best fit your lifestyles. Head to deltagketones.com. All links, promos, and discounts can be found in the show notes as well as every episode landing page. All right, Hayden, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man. I've been wanting to get on your podcast for, you know, months now, and we finally made it happen. So happy to be on here with you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good timing, and I certainly appreciate you coming on now after, what are we, just maybe about a week and a half removed from what has to be one of the more fulfilling races of your career, I would guess.
yeah, for sure. It was very meaningful. Definitely was a special race for me. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. And it was a really exciting day and just a very special day for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just in general, I think with the sport of ultra running, it's just getting to this point now where we have, since you and I have been in the sport, it's, you know, Western States has always been like a heavily competitive, sought after event where more or less the understanding is if you're standing on the line at Western States, you're going to be up against some of the stiffest competition that you can find in the trail side of the sport for sure. Now we have, I would argue, a few events that are sort of creeping up towards that in terms of you could make a fair argument that they're as close as they've ever been to Western States in terms of competitiveness. And I would say Black Canyon's definitely one of those. So you're here 9 days off of winning and setting the course record at the Black Canyon 100K. And to add a little bit of interest to the storyline, I would say is that was your first race back, right? You didn't do any training races or anything leading to that after your knee surgery?
No, yeah, it was my first race back. So I got knee surgery on July 13th of 2023. And just kind of went through a lot of rehab, did a lot of, you know, different styles of training with a lot of cross training, a lot of strength training, just really worked my butt off to get back, you know, to where I needed to be to race again. And I honestly didn't feel like I needed to put in a race, you know, in the fall or try and force anything, before Black Canyon. I was going to run like a 50K, but I decided my knee wasn't ready yet. It just didn't feel like it would be able to hold up and that it might actually put me backwards. So I decided to forego that and just set my sights on Black Canyon. And honestly, Black Canyon was a bit of a question mark for me as well, until about 4 to 6 weeks out from race day. I told myself I was going to, you know, continue to rehab, continue to do what I needed to do, and see how it responded, you know, see how my knee felt, do some training runs out on the course and different things like that to see exactly if it would be able to hold up for that distance. And especially, you know, at those speeds and with that competition and everything else. And, I gave myself a deadline. I said, you know, 4 weeks out, I'll make the decision. So let's see, you know, what happens, see how the knee feels. And then 4 weeks out, you make that decision if you're going to do Black Canyon or not. And so, yeah, about 4 weeks out, I made the decision that, yeah, I can do this. You know, I felt confident enough in the knee, felt confident enough in my training and felt like it could go really well and was excited, you know, really happy, I guess, really happy that I made that decision to run Black Canyon.
Yeah, it's actually an interesting topic with our sport because if you're doing, obviously running in general, there's going to be a difference on competition day or race day, but in most of the standard Olympic distances, you can sort of stress test your body to the degree where when you're standing on the start line, you're like, okay, I know it can hold up to the workload that I'm going to put it through in this, you know, handful of hours or whatever it happens to be. Whereas when you start getting into things like the Black Canyon 100K, where, you know, if you're as fast as you are, you finish in 7.5 hours, that's probably more stress on your body than you're able to do in a single session and training in most cases. So there's this like kind of background noise, I would say, like when you're coming off of an injury, the first race back of you're not 100% certain that your body really is to a point where it can tolerate that. And you're to some degree guessing and just hoping for the best.
Yeah, I would say it's physically and mentally. You know, a lot of people, like mentally, they have a hard time throwing themselves into a big competitive race like Black Canyon, and being confident enough to do that. You know, for me, I've been in the sport for 8 years now. You know, I have consistently ran the most competitive races in the world. You know, I've gone to UTMB like every year since I started my ultra running career, you know, running one of the distances there. I've ran Western States 3 times, you know. You were talking about, you know, early on about how like we have a lot of races that are comparable to Western States competitive wise. You know, in Europe, there's been a lot of those races, I would say, that are very comparable to Western States, just with the nature of the sport out there and having a little bit more flexibility on how many elites they can add to their race and whatnot, and just the depth of competition in Europe. And I've raced in Europe, you know, from the start of my career, and I've raced Lavaredo. I've raced a lot of very competitive races in Europe that I would say compare to Western States. So mentally I felt fine. I felt like I didn't need a race to mentally have the confidence and be ready to race something like Black Canyon. I would say physically is kind of where I was at, because I still felt a little bit of pain in my knee about 8 weeks out, maybe even 6 weeks out. Was a little nervous about it. I did get like an extra or another MRI and X-ray just to make sure like everything was cleaned out, that the doctor, you know, did a good job on my knee and that it wasn't going to hurt me if I were to, you know, run a 100-kilometer distance. And that was a reassurance to me when I came, you know, when they gave me the results and it was like, hey, you're good. Like nothing you do to this knee is going to hurt it. Like it's clean, it's good. And so that definitely helped. But I think the biggest thing for me was I did do a stress test where I went out to the course. So the Black Canyon course is about 5-6 hour drive from my house. And I made the decision that I was going to go out and do a small training camp out on the course, like a 3-4 day camp, get on the course, get specific, you know, work with my crew, do all these little things that might help me for the race. But also the point of that training camp was to test my body. So I did some big days before, like 1 or 2 pretty big days on the course. And then on the third day, I actually did the first 60 kilometers of the race at race pace. So this was 4 weeks out. I did that 60K and I did it under course record, and I did it about what I ran on race day. And so I had the physical, I guess, confidence after I did that 60K that my knee would be just fine, and that I was fit enough and strong enough to be able to run course record pace. And that's kind of was the last, I guess, thing that I needed to make the decision to not just physically, but mentally decide to run Black Canyon.
Excellent. Yeah, it is, I'm sure, very confirming when you can do a 60K training run on course at course record pace. And then presumably if you're doing a camp, get up the next morning and put in some time and know that your knee isn't necessarily going to be something that's going to hold you back.
Yeah. And I think it can come off maybe a bit risky to do something like that, but honestly, 100K race pace or like course record pace isn't that hard of a training run for me. Like it is, but it's not like it's like, you know, running marathon race pace or 10K race pace or something like that. You know, most of my training runs are close to 100K race pace, but of course I'm doing it for 100 kilometers. In this instance, I was doing it for 60K. So I felt like 4 weeks was enough time to be able to recover. And because I hadn't been racing, you know, leading into the race, I was able to do that. So it was, in essence, it was like getting a B race in before my A race being Black Canyon, but it was on my own. It was under my own conditions. You know, I was able to do it exactly how I needed to. So honestly, I think it was a good preparation for the race.
Yeah. I mean, given the circumstances, I would say a controlled 60K where you can just mimic exactly what you want to do on race day is probably a better decision than jumping in a 60K or a 50K to kind of tune up for it. And you obviously had the opportunity to do that. So it makes total sense to me. I want to fill the listeners in a little bit about the background as we just kind of started talking about your rehab from knee injury, and we're talking about Western States. And I know you're on the record saying very openly that it is a goal of yours to win the Western States 100 as well as Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, which for followers of the sport will know that that's no small feat. That's a legendary feat, I'll say. So it's cool that, you know, individuals like yourself are willing to kind of put yourself out there and make that kind of a public focus of yours. And The reason I bring that up is because last year at the Western States 100, I was spectating and, crewing and pacing and just being a general fan of the sport of that particular event specifically. And I was just thinking, like, if I had to pick who's going to win this year, who are the kind of the guys on the short list? And you were definitely one of them. So you were fit heading in. Presumably you were confident that it was a year that you were going to be able to execute and win the race. Unfortunately, as Western States tends to be, it's a little bit of a coin flip as to what you're actually going to get, especially in those first 30 or so miles in the high country. And this year, or I should say last year, there's a lot of snow up there. And, you had a bit of an unfortunate situation that had you withdraw from the race. Do you want to just fill us in as to kind of what kind of it played there at Western States?
Yeah, so that was my third time, running Western States. The first year I was the eighth male, to finish. Second year I took second place. I was second overall. And then this third time I went in with a lot of confidence, feeling like, man, I'm fitter than I've ever been. I have my nutrition, I have my hydration dialed in. I'd learned from the past mistakes, from the two previous years. And Western States is my style of race. It has a good mix of everything that I really tend to do well at. It has some really good runnable stuff, but it also has some good elevation gain and some climbing and different things like that that I tend to excel at. So I was like, this is my race. Like, I'm ready to go. I had dialed in everything that I needed to do for race day. And then I think it was about 2 weeks before the race, I kind of started feeling this slight pain in my knee. Well, this pain had been kind of off and on for about 3 years. And I was like, no, like, not again. Like, it's coming back. Cause I'd gone through a section where I didn't really feel it much and it felt like it had gone away. And then about 2 weeks before the race, I started feeling this pain underneath my patellar tendon on my left knee. And was like, man, like, this is pretty bad. And it came back even worse this time. Like, it felt pretty bad. I had to cut a lot of my mileage. I had to kind of adjust some things with my training. And I was like, man, like, I don't even know, like, if I'm going to be able to start the race. And if I do start the race, I don't know if I'm going to be able to finish the race. And then, but I decided to start anyways. And I started the race and I was running in the high country, like you said, in the snow. And I took a pretty bad fall. I fell into this like snow, I guess, ledge. Like, there was this snow bridge, I guess you'd call it, where the snow just gave. And when the snow gave, I stepped into it and I fell into like a pile of rocks that were on the other side because the snow had been melted a bit on the other side. And there was like a little bit of a stream coming through there. And I smashed that left knee that was already hurting me into a rock. And when that happened, it like immediate pain. I mean, it hurt so bad. And I took a minute there to kind of compose myself and see, like, kind of feel it out, see if I could continue to run. Limped on it a bit to, to try and move it and get some motion going. And it felt good enough that I could still kind of run, walk on it. And so I did that for the next like mile or two, and I could run the ups, but I couldn't really run the downs. And it kind of got a little bit better. But then once we started hitting the really steep downhills on that, after Robinson Flat, it started getting worse and worse and worse. And the more runnable the downhill, the steeper the downhill, the worse it would get. And yeah, I ended up having to drop out. I made it all the way to Michigan Bluff, pretty much walking most of it. And at Michigan Bluff, my crew was there and I had to end up dropping out of Western States halfway through, which was very disappointing. And later on, I found out that I had fractured. I had a bone spur underneath my patellar tendon that was giving me the issues. And I didn't realize that. And then when I had fallen, I had fractured that spur. And so now I had this bone spur with a fracture on it. And it's just sitting there rubbing on my patellar tendon. And that's, I guess, the issue that I was dealing with.
Yeah, so you're going to have to get that taken care of at some point in time. Either way, it was like Western States maybe was just the point that forced the issue a little bit.
Yeah, it was a blessing in disguise, to be honest with you, because I kept pushing it off. And like my coach and my wife and other people had like encouraged me to go to the doctor to get it checked out. Because my wife, you know, she'd seen me fighting it for years and she's like, man, like you should go to the doctor and get this checked out. And I was like, no, I'm good. Like, because it would kind of go away and then it would come back. And I'd be like, it's fine, it's fine. I thought, honestly, it was just patellar tendonitis. I mean, in essence, it kind of was because that spur was just rubbing on the tendon, causing that, you know, inflammation of the tendon there. But yeah, like falling and actually fracturing it and realizing like, man, this is pretty bad. This is a serious situation. I need to figure out what's going on. It forced me to go to the doctor. It forced me to get the surgery. They went in, they removed the spur, which also removed the fracture. Because the fracture was on the spur, which alleviated pain pretty immediately. But then they had to shave, you know, and clean up the area, which that took a little bit longer to recover from. And getting the motion and back from them having to cut the tendon, of course, was a little bit of a process. But I could tell that it was going to be a lot better just by removing that spur. It definitely made a big difference.
What was it like when so you have the surgery and everything done? Was it a pretty clear like trajectory as to like this is what I have to do, and it's a timeline thing in terms of like when you can kind of start some strength work, when you can start running, and then about when you'd maybe have an opportunity to be back to full steam?
No, not necessarily. So the doctor did say at first, he's like, I think you can be back in like 2 to 3 months, but we'll see, you know, how the, because the biggest thing was when you shave a bone, of course, it has to recalcify. And that recalcification process can take a while. You know, we don't 100% know how the body's going to react. But getting motion in it was the first step, of course. And then the recalcification process was just going to take time. And yes, I did do some things to help aid in that process. But the biggest thing was movement, actually. And that started almost immediately after the surgery. I mean, the next day I'm sitting there trying to stretch it, move it, you know, do anything I could. Of course, it wasn't moving a lot, you know, but it just continually progressed and progressed and progressed. And I had a lot of help. I mean, I had a lot of people in my corner helping me. Have some really good friends that are physical therapists. Actually, an athlete that I coach who's a physical therapist at Virginia Tech University, and I was talking to him a lot on the phone. He was sending me, you know, strength training and movement exercises to help get it going, and he was pushing me because I would message him and be like, hey man, like, are you sure I'm supposed to be stretching it like this? And because it kind of hurts. And he's like, yes, like you need to get the movement. Like it's okay to feel a little bit of pain. And so I kind of like, as soon as I accepted that, it really helped because I was able to really get that movement going and stretch it like it needed to. But yeah, my coach helped me a lot. My coach is Robbie Britton. I've been working with him for a few years now, and he really helped me a ton. Of course, my parents, my wife, some people within the community. And it was just kind of a joint effort to get me back to where I needed to be. I hired a strength coach, and that was another thing, is like strengthening all the muscles and everything around that stabilized the knee, and getting that balance back was so key in the process as well. And so I think it was a good thing because honestly, a lot of these things that I learned post-surgery, I wasn't doing. I probably wouldn't have been able to continue to have the career I want to have for the next, you know, 5, 10 years, whatever it is, if I wouldn't have developed these habits that I did during this rehab process.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I know for me personally, I've had a similar trajectory where it was like strength training was always something I was interested in, but it was definitely not my number one passion. So it was like you get into the thick of a training block or you get busy for one reason or the other, and it's like it's easy to trade strength training in for some more miles or strength training in for something else that feels a little more like exciting in the moment. But I would say over the last nearly year or so now, it's become kind of a non-negotiable where it's like, if I want to do the running that I know is going to get me where I want to be, that includes these movements, these routines, and they need to be as consistent as the running itself, or the running won't be there. So Sounds like you're learning that as well. And it's something where now when you kind of look at your training plan, it's just that's part of the process more or less.
Yeah. My training plan is a lot more balanced now, which is awesome. Like I'm actually running less miles than I have my entire career. So the previous, 7 years of my career, I was kind of known as a high mileage guy where I was running, 130, 150 mile weeks sometimes, probably averaging right around 120 miles a week. In this block to Black Canyon, I hit 120 mile running week. That was my biggest week. And that's when I went out and did that camp on the course. But every other week was between 80 to 100 miles a week, which is less than I've done in the past. But I'm also incorporating a lot more cycling. So in the rehab process, cycling was kind of one of the first things that I could do. And that movement on the bike actually really helped my knee to kind of stretch out and to get that movement back to where it needed to be. And I've cycled for years now, but I really started incorporating more of it during this block of training after, or going into Black Canyon after my surgery. And I've continued to do it. And honestly, that cycling's built a lot of like leg muscle that I need, because, I'm a pretty thin guy. I don't have the biggest legs in the world. And strength, like just overall strength and balance was a thing that I was lacking. We did a lot of testing with my strength coach and we saw that, hey, I'm lacking a lot just with leg strength. And the bike, I'm able to push a little bit harder on the bike. It works the muscles a bit differently. It builds some muscle that I need on my legs and it gives me a lot more leg strength, plus incorporating the strength training as well. So my overall hours are actually higher than they've probably ever been of actual training, but it's more distributed. It's distributed evenly with strength, cross training, and running. So I'm not taking the running completely out, but I am lowering it a little bit and then incorporating more strength and more cross training, which is making me a more well-balanced athlete. And it's helping me actually focus on my weak areas when before I was just run all the time. Now I'm actually being more specific and focusing on what I need to be a more well-rounded athlete.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, people sometimes underestimate how almost direct biking can or cycling can be for, especially like I think mountain trail running, where the mechanics and just like a muscular endurance you can develop from just pedaling versus running can aid in things like how strong you feel climbing up the side of a nice steep climb that you're certainly going to see at Western States. So in terms of removing some of the impact and the things that tend to create the limiter on running, it's a nice little thing where you can add in. And then when you find a rotation like you have, you may actually end up doing more training and be more actually fit just with more inputs. So that's really cool to hear. I know you've been cycling for a while now, because I do remember this is probably a couple of years ago at this point. I remember you made a post, I think on Instagram, where you were talking about how you had sort of switched your model from at some points hitting like upwards to 150 miles per week to taking a day where you didn't run at all just by default and having a cycling day built in there. This would have probably been maybe 2 or 3 years ago at this point. So it seemed like you were maybe a little early to that game in terms of like how much you were willing to kind of like say, all right, I'm going to take my foot off the gas pedal a little bit with all these like mega mile training weeks and supplement them with some other stuff.
Yeah. And I think it not only helps physically, like you said, like biking's a lot easier, on the body because it's non-impact. You can do a lot more volume and not feel as beat up as you would with running. But also, like, I think the other thing is mentally cycling helps me because I love it. It's fun. It's enjoyable. And it's so much easier for me to go do a cycling double than do a run double. Like I'll do my morning run and then I'll do a bike in the afternoon. And that it's fun to me. It's awesome because I look forward to jumping on the bike, and I have a different community here in Cedar City that I actually bike with. They're not runners, they're cyclists. But I really enjoy spending time with my running community and my cycling community, and it mixes it up for me. So it's really nice in that way as well. I have a mentor here in town that's really helped me a lot too. She's been helping me for a while now, but her and her husband. So her name is Paula Newby Frazier. She's an 8-time Ironman world champion. So she's won Kona 8 times and she lives here in town in Cedar City, her and her husband. And they've really helped me a lot to just be more professional and smarter with how I train. And, you know, she, of course, is a multi-sport athlete, you know, swimming, biking, running. And she was talking to me a lot about like cycling and how cycling could really help me. And so that was kind of the initial, I guess, start of it. And then ever since, you know, she's been helping me with some different strength training, with different ways to, you know, set my schedule up, with different ways to incorporate different styles of training at different periods of time. So between her, my coach, Robbie Britton, and then another friend in town who used to be a professional cyclist, Burke Swindlehurst, I've really started to bring that biking in and just be a lot more balanced with how I'm training. And it's not just physically, but mentally just been really, really good for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it sounds like you have a really good setup there. You were up in Boulder for a little bit too, I want to say. I mean, Cedar City is where you're from, and then you made a move to Boulder for a while, presumably for the training mecca that it is, but you eventually decided to go back to Cedar City?
Yeah. We tried Boulder, you know, for the longest. So we're from here in Southern Utah. I'm from St. George. My wife's from Cedar City. I went to school here at Southern Utah University in Cedar City. And we had been here for our whole lives. You know, we travel a lot, of course. We've spent some time in New Zealand and Europe and whatnot. But we kind of wanted to test out the waters just to see what it was like to live in a mecca, you know, like a running mecca, training mecca. So, you know, we were going between Flagstaff and Boulder. We'd spend some time in Flagstaff, but we just felt like Boulder might be a cool place to try out. So we moved to Boulder for a short period of time, and it was nice. We really enjoyed it, but it just wasn't home. You know, we have two kids, and just finding that balance with family, friends, and my career and everything, we felt like we had that here in Cedar City, and we didn't have that in Boulder because, of course, we were missing family and some other aspects as well that kept us balanced. So we decided to move back home to Cedar City. You know, the surgery kind of maybe spurred it on a bit quicker than we would have thought. But it was like, well, I'm getting the surgery. Let's just move home. Let's move back into our house that we were renting at the time and, you know, have the support and everything that we need here. You know, it's so nice to have parents and brothers and sisters and everything, especially with the kids. And, you know, we sit at 6,000 feet here in Cedar City. So it's a perfect place for altitude training. And honestly, we call it a mini Boulder. It really is. It's like Boulder used to be back in the 60s or the 70s. It's a small town, but it's at altitude right on the base of the mountains, and it's an amazing place to live and train for sure.
Yeah, you're really not giving up much in terms of the training environment you have available to you by going back to Cedar City. It really is a nice spot that is just less recognized than Boulder. So I'm sure you're getting your fill in terms of altitude exposure, steep climbs and descents and everything. That's going to be really good tools for preparing for the events that you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, we have the Tusher Mountains like right out our front door, like pretty close, you know. If anybody's ever seen the Tusher Mountain race, like it's a pretty legit mountain range with, you know, 13,000 foot peaks. And it's a really, you know, awesome spot to go train and get really specific mountain training. But then we also have St. George, which is 30-40 minutes away, which is a desert. You know, and gets up to 100+ degrees in the summertime. So honestly, for like Western States training, Cedar City's ideal because a lot of the trails here in Cedar and just up the mountain are very, very similar to the high country of Western States. And then you can go down to St. George, you know, beginning of June, you know, as you're training for Western States, and you can get that heat training in. So we got a little bit of everything, honestly, and it's a really nice spot to live. It's affordable, and we have family and friends to keep us balanced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to pivot a little bit back to Black Canyon, actually, because one of the reasons why I find you such a fun person to follow is because you're pretty open about some of the stuff that you're doing and kind of the reasoning behind it and stuff like that. So after Black Canyon, I think very shortly after, you posted some details about kind of how you went about fueling and hydrating that particular event. And I wanted to dive into this topic with you because I know you've also, this isn't just like numbers that I presume you were just guessing at and they happened to land there. You've also done a fair bit of testing, treadmill testing in various conditions to really kind of fine tune what it is you're going to want to try to execute from the fueling and hydration side of it. But for the listeners, you had posted that from on the Black Canyon 100K. So this is a 7.5 hour effort. You were averaging 109 grams of carbohydrate per hour, 486 milliliters per hour of fluid, and 1,063 milligrams per liter of electrolytes. I found that interesting because, for one, I wanted to ask you just like, was that the plan to target roughly those numbers? Did you have to, out of necessity, for one reason or another, deviate from the original plan and that's just where it landed? Or what can you tell us about kind of how that ended up getting structured and then put into place?
Yeah, so that was the plan the whole time, was to hit over 100 grams of carbohydrates per hour. Of course, the hydration strategy changed a bit as the race went on, and I didn't know exactly what the temperatures were going to be. But that is one thing that I do test a lot. So one of the reasons I go out before races, or, you know, train in a very similar environment to what I'm going to encounter on race day, is to test out some of these fueling strategies and hydration strategies to know exactly at what points in the race I'm going to be drinking. So, you know, the amount of liquid that I need to be taking in, the amount of carbohydrates, see if my body can handle it in these certain, you know, weather conditions and different situations. And it's something I actually focus a lot on, is trying to get all that fueling down as best that I possibly can. Of course, you cannot control everything, but I feel very prepared going into races that if the weather is to shift or change or the temperatures change, I know kind of the numbers that I need to be targeting at certain times and in certain climates. And so I really do focus on that a lot. You know, I work with Precision Hydration, Fuel and Hydration, which is an amazing company. You know, I've done some testing with them. I meet, you know, on video calls with them at least once or twice a month to go over things and bounce ideas off of them. And so, yeah, that's been really helpful to have, you know, their support in helping me dial all these numbers in. And over the years, I've just consistently raised that number. Like when I first started, you know, ultra running, I wasn't getting much carbohydrates in. Like I thought I was, but I was probably only getting like 30 to 50 grams in per hour, maybe less in some races. And as I've trained my gut over the years to target different, you know, numbers, I slowly was able to raise up to 60 grams an hour and then 90 grams an hour. And now I can do over 100 grams an hour, but it's taken a lot of practice. You know, I fuel pretty much on any run over 90 minutes, I will do some form of race day fueling. That is to train my gut to be able to handle those liquids and those carbohydrates, but also my mind, you know, to be able to consistently eat and make that kind of just a routine. That way on race day, it's no different than I've done in practice. And a lot of these like training camps that I do, I'm targeting those numbers. And yeah, like going into Black Canyon, I had no gut issues. I had no bathroom issues targeting those numbers. And so I stuck to the plan. And on race day, I was able to hit those numbers exactly how I wanted to and had no issues along the way on race day as well. And, you know, having those higher numbers just allows me to be able to sustain faster paces and faster efforts or harder efforts for longer periods of time. And it just makes sense, right? The more fuel you put in, the harder you can go, the faster, longer you can go.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be interested, when you've done your testing in the past, have you gotten tests that would suggest that your carb and fat metabolism is going to be at a certain ratio at certain intensities that you're building that stuff off of? Or is it more, I mean, I would imagine 109 grams per hour, it's super unlikely you're not going to have your glycogen defended. So it could be something where you're like, well, if I can get this in, why not? Because it's going to supplement it. Or did you actually have the lab results show like, hey, at this intensity, this is my split, this is about how many calories per hour it's going to take for me to sustain each hour of this race, and therefore that's the number I'm aiming for?
Yeah, so we did some of that testing when I went out to Liverpool a couple of years ago. And yeah, we kind of have those numbers, but then it also became, it got down to like, hey, let's let's just test a little bit more. Let's test a little bit more just to see, you know, see if I could handle it. And if I could, if I was going to have any issues with it. And it's just kind of slowly increased just a little bit. And, you know, even going into this block, we were a little nervous about hitting those numbers. But as I did it, you know, training run after training run after training run, you know, I think my longest run doing it was around 5 hours and I held up perfect, had no issues. It was like, well, like, let's try it, you know, let's try it on race day. And it ended up working out really well. So yeah, I do have some of those numbers. I'd probably want to test them again, you know, just because I feel like I'm at a little different spot now too, fitness wise and different things like that, and just efficiency and whatnot. But yeah, I do, it was just kind of more of like, let's test it and see if you can handle it.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you're going to aim for in a similar manner at Western States, or is going up to 100 miles and then the additional duration that entails with that change your fueling strategy at all?
I mean, we'll see. I'm going to do some test runs with it, you know, some longer runs. Probably will never, you know, I'm not going to get up to 10 plus hours with it, but I will. I mean, I did it for 7.5 hours here, right? And I might do another 7-8 hour effort, you know, with the same fueling strategy to see. But yeah, that is the plan, is to, you know, continue to do the same thing at something like Western States. I've trained a lot with Jim Walmsley over the years, and I know Jim is getting 100+ grams of carbs in per hour. And that's kind of where I got the idea from, because I was out on some training runs with him and I was asking him about his fueling and kind of calculated in my head. And I was like, wow, this guy's getting, you know, close to 100 grams in per hour. Like, maybe this is what it takes, you know, to be able, and I need to do the same thing. So that's when I first started testing it, and, you know, it's worked for me. It's really worked. And a big reason is the Precision Fuel and Hydration products. They're just easy for me to get in. They're pretty much flavorless, and I don't do well with flavors, but I can get in, you know, flavorless stuff pretty easily. It's this textures as well. And the Precision texture seems to work really well for me. And so, yeah, I will, because I mean, Western States is, pretty high intensity race. I mean, for the course record at Western States, it's like, I think the average pace is like 8:30, right? My course record at Black Canyon, the average pace was 7:20. So it's not that far off, especially considering the elevation gain is a lot more at something like Western States. But yeah, and of course on those climbs at Western States, that's going to require a little bit more glycogen. I'm going to be burning a little bit hotter, you know, as I'm climbing up some of those big climbs, you know, coming out of Devil's Thumb and whatever else. And so, yes, I do think, like, to be able to do what I want to do at Western States and the goal that I have at Western States, I need to be hitting those same numbers.
Yeah, I had Elof Olsen on the podcast after he ran very quickly at the Tunnel Hill 100 mile earlier, at the end of last year. And he was targeting, he's a bit of a higher fuel guy himself. He said for like 50 or 80K to 100K type efforts, he's typically up into the 100 gram per hour range. He did say he brought his down to like, I think 80, 85 for 100 miles, because he thought like the relative intensity would be as such that he wouldn't quite need to. And for him, it sounds like maybe you're a little bit different than him in terms of where that line is, but he said when he starts getting up to 100, that's where he kind of starts noticing with like continued input, he starts getting a bit of a bottlenecking in his digestion. And then he just knows if he starts feeling that to kind of like scale back for a little bit. And that's, I want to say, if I remember it, that's how he ended up in like the 80s, was because he was just sort of, you know, more or less feeling the way he had in the past. And he was just listening to those signals that his body was giving him along the way and making sure not to try to like kind of overrun the system, so to speak, if it was screaming at him. So, yeah, I find this stuff really interesting to talk about, though, because I know it's like Killian's released some of the information about his fueling strategy of recent. I think Tom Evans said or talked about a little bit what he did at UTMB when he was third. So I find it to be a fun conversation.
Yeah, I know from the testing that I've done, I know that like 90 grams is sufficient. You know, like if I could get in around 90 grams in per hour, I should be just fine. So that is kind of like the lowest number that I'd probably want to, you know, target. But if I can get in, you know, 100, 110 grams, like why not? You know, it might allow me to do just a little bit more. But yeah, I'd probably have a similar, I guess, strategy as Elof, is like I'd probably start around that 100 gram per hour. But if things were to bottleneck or I feel a little bit, you know, nauseous or something like that, and I feel like I need to back off just a little bit, I could back it down to like that 80 to 90 range. And I know that I would be just fine at that. But I haven't experienced that yet over these 7, you know, 8 hour distances. But of course, Western States is 14, 15 hours, you know, potentially 13 hours on the right day. I think I could handle it, but I always have an A, B plan just in case, you know, things were to change and I needed to adjust on the fly.
Yeah. And to some degree, sometimes that's the name of the game with 100 milers, is waiting for something to happen you didn't plan for and knowing how to adjust when it does so that you don't have it hit you too hard. And accepting that that's probably going to happen to everybody, so that to some degree, you just take your turn and then hope that you're able to keep things moving in the right direction to the point where you're where you want to be at the end of the day, which for you sounds like is going to be on the top of that podium if things go well.
Yeah, that's the plan. That's the plan, but got to execute. So.
Right on. No, I'm sure it'll be fun to watch you compete. Here are some discounts and promos for the HPO sponsors. I have a full breakdown of how I use each of these products at the end of every episode. S-Fuels has a 15% site-wide discount and right now are running a free 30-serving pack of their S-Fuels Train product with promo code HPOTRAIN. Hurry up on this one, though. They have a limited number of supplies. Go to sfuelsgolonger.com, promo code HPOTRAIN. Jonji Apparel has 10% off with promo code BITTER10. Check out their AFO shorts if you're in the market for a new pair of running or gym shorts. That's janji.com, JANJI.com. Element Electrolytes has a free sample pack with purchase and satisfaction guarantee, meaning if you don't like it, they will give you your money back. No questions asked. And you don't even have to return the box. Go to drinklmnt.com/HPO to get that free sample pack and try out all their flavors with your purchase. Finally, Delta G Ketones has 20% off with BITTER20 promo code. And they also offer free consultations to help you assess how their product would best fit your lifestyles. Head to deltagketones.com. All links, promos, and discounts can be found in the show notes as well as every episode landing page. I did want to ask about just the other side of that strategy where, to be honest, like when I saw that you did 109 grams of carbohydrate per hour, I wasn't overly shocked at that because I've just seen other people target those high numbers in the past successfully. And I know that people are playing around with that. So it's something where I think we'll see that occur more often, or at least people are going to share more often what they're doing. The one that I thought was kind of interesting was your fluid intake was 486 milliliters per hour. And I would say, like, generally speaking, that's on the low end. Did you arrive at that number due to testing that you did where you recognized that that's about what you were going to lose per hour? Was there any kind of reasoning behind that particular target?
Yeah, it was testing in the lab, but also testing on the course itself. So when I did the recce on the course, it was actually very similar conditions to what we encountered on race day. And I had tested out, you know, certain amount of liquid, and I realized that I was a little too high, actually. Like, I was drinking too much at those temperatures, because at the start of the race, it was 27 degrees, you know, and you're not going to be drinking a whole lot at 27 degrees. And when I did the recce, it was really similar. I think it was like 29, 30 degrees when I had started that as well. And the amount of liquid that I was drinking during the recce, I was just peeing constantly. I mean, I couldn't, you know, absorb what I needed to. And so I was definitely drinking too much and was like, okay, I need to back that number off just a little bit. So I practiced it a little bit here in Cedar City, which is somewhat similar conditions. And I went out early in the morning, tested it out at, you know, different temperatures depending on the day. And I kind of figured out exactly where I needed to. So I wanted to be kind of in that state of where I felt like I maybe needed to pee, but I didn't need to pee that bad. And then, so, and that's exactly what happened on race day, is there was instances where I felt like I kind of needed to pee, but then it would go away. And so it showed me that I was right where I needed to be. I was utilizing the liquid that I was taking in and able to absorb it. And of course I've been sweat tested numerous times, so I do know my sodium intake, you know, compared to my liquid. And so I knew those numbers. And so I just pretty much, as I adjust the fluid, I adjust the sodium intake. And so that's kind of where those numbers came into play. But the numbers are a bit lower than maybe people might see, because at the beginning of the race, it was 27 degrees, but by the end of the race, it was 60. So I adjusted the hydration as I went, right? At the beginning, I was maybe only drinking 200 to 300 milliliters per hour. By the end, I was drinking 800 milliliters per hour. And so we met in the middle at right around 500 milliliters per hour is where I sat. So, and that's the thing, is you do need to adjust as the temperatures, you know, change and the conditions change. Like, you can't just stick to one number and be like, I'm going to do 500 milliliters every hour. Doesn't matter how hot or cold it is. No, that's not proper hydration.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. You prompted my next question too with that, whereas when you're doing events like this, it is a moving target, and having the data that supports the range is important, because like you said, if you know what you're losing at that below freezing temperature, and then you 2, or in the case of Western states, 3-4x that maybe in the canyons, it's just going to be a different number. And it's not something where you can kind of bank early, or you'll find yourself stopping to pee all the time and then potentially dehydrated if you don't stay on top of it in the heat. So have you done testing yet where you know, like 100 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that, what your fluid loss is in that environment versus the 27 degrees Fahrenheit?
I've done a little bit, but that's what I'll do, you know, in the coming months. Like I said, I can drop down to St. George and it's 100 plus degrees down there, you know, in May and June. And I will do some runs down there to test out my fluid intake to see exactly where I need to be. And that is something that I do pay attention to. Like, I will go out for a run and I'll look at my phone and see what temperature it is. And I'll bring, you know, the fluid that I think. And if I feel like I didn't get enough, then I'll bring a little bit more the next time I go out at that certain temperature. And this is something I will do going into Western states, is I'll probably do some morning runs around the same temperature as I might encounter in the morning of Western states. And then I'll do some runs maybe in the afternoon, and then I'll do some runs in the evening to kind of see exactly where I need to be fluid wise along the way. The other thing that we've thought about doing, and I do, like, I'll weigh myself before and after too, to kind of see what my sweat loss is. But another thing that I might do as well is, we have a portable sweat testing machine that I can bring on some runs with me. And I don't know exactly if it'll help or not, but we're going to test it out a bit in different temperatures to kind of see exactly kind of maybe a ballpark range of where my numbers need to be. That way, when I go into Western states, I kind of know exactly at what stages of the race I need to be hitting certain hydration numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting stuff, and just the access to this type of information that we have now is pretty fun. I had my sweat test done actually with one of those precision machines that I'm sure you've been hooked up to that gives you the output of your electrolyte loss. So that was going to be my next question, was I'm guessing you know from that the 1,063 milligrams per liter of electrolytes that you took in was somewhere near where you would see your loss at if we hooked you up to one of those machines?
Yeah. Yep. I've been tested numerous times. My numbers are right in that range. So that's where I know I need to be hitting, according to, you know, how many milliliters or liters of water I'm drinking. And that's, I think, important to recognize as well, that it's not per hour how many milligrams of sodium you need to be taking in. It's per liter of liquid that you're taking in. So for me, I'm usually right around that 1-to-1. So if I'm drinking, 1,000 milliliters of water or a liter of water, I need to be taking in 1,000 milligrams of sodium. It's pretty easy math for me, but for some people it's a lot higher. Some people it's a lot lower. Like my wife tested at, I think 1500 or 1600 milligrams per liter of sodium. And then I have an athlete that I work with who tested at 500 milligrams of sodium per liter. So she's a lot lower. My wife's a lot higher. I'm kind of there in the middle. So I think it's important to recognize that. But yeah, I think it's just like the important thing is to take the time and get as specific as possible. You know, like it's pretty easy to do these things. You just have to do it. Like you just have to think about it. Like, you know, how easy it is it to just go and like look at your phone and see what the temperature is, you know, and be like, okay, well, I'm drinking 500 milliliters per hour at this temperature. This seems to be about right. No, maybe I need to add a little bit more. Maybe I need to take a little bit, you know, less. And then it's just pretty simple to do that. You just gotta, I guess, be aware of it and take the time to just do it. And I think it can alleviate a lot of issues, especially those nutrition, hydration issues that most people encounter on race day. I mean, that is the number one reason why most people struggle in races or DNF is a nutrition or a hydration issue. And so dialing all that in is very important. Like this morning, I was actually on a call with Precision Fuel and Hydration talking about my plan for Western States. And so we're 4.5 months out from Western States and I'm already getting all everything set up. We were talking about cooling strategies. We were talking about crewing methods and we were getting all that put together now. That way in this next block of training that I'm going to do, I can practice those things. That way, when I show up on race day 4.5 months from now, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I have no question. I'm completely prepared. I don't have to stress about all those things, you know, in the week leading into the race. I know exactly who my crew is going to be, what we're going to do. We've ran through it all together and we're ready to go. And so the chances of things going bad are a lot less. You know, and we also have backup plans just in case something does happen. But it's like doing that in advance is so important, you know, and that's why I was on the call this morning with them, you know, 4.5 months before race day.
Yeah. It's a lot of logistics with Western States. And I think like when you are at a spot where you are, where, you know, you finish second there, it's like, there's only one spot to go to better yourself, and that's winning. So, you know, in order to win a race like that, you want to have everything set up so that your T's are crossed and your I's are dotted. And you're certainly in the process of doing that right now, it sounds like, which is exciting for me to hear.
Yeah. Like I think somebody asked me after Black Canyon, they're like, oh man, this is such a big win for you. Like, I'm sure you're so stoked. You're happy about it. And I'm like, yeah, I'm very happy about it. It's a special day. I'm definitely stoked about any win that I get, especially a win at Black Canyon. But I said, this is a semifinal. You know, the final is Western States. Like, this is a stepping stone to Western States for me. And that's exactly how I took it. Like, the day after Western States, I was on the phone with my coach planning stuff for Western States. And it's like, I celebrate. Yeah, I enjoy it. I had a great time with my family. But now I'm moving on and I'm trying to prepare myself to have the best day possible at Western States because I want more than anything to win that race. And I know what I'm capable of at that race. You know, I've never ran a complete race at Western States. I've done well. You know, that second place was probably the closest I've come to complete race, but I messed up on so many things that day that I think caused me to take second place. And honestly, like, I know what I'm capable of on that course. I know what time I'm capable of running. I would just want to run a complete race there. And I know if I can run a complete race, I can have a great day. I can run a super fast time and, I can potentially win, you know, and it's just focusing on what I can control. I'm not focused on the things I can't control. Like, I'm not focused on my competition. I'm not focused on what Jim Walmsley or John Albin or so-and-so, whoever else is in the race is doing. Because I can't control any of that. I'm focused on my training. I'm focused on how I can prepare for the heat, the fueling, the hydration, all these different things. And as I focus on what I can control, I know that I'll show up on race day prepared. And as I dial in those things, I'm really hard to beat. I can't control if Jim beats me and he has a better day than me, but I can control what I can do so that I can run a fast time and make it hard for him or whoever else to try and beat me. And so that's what I focus on.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's one of those things where the duration is so long. If you start running someone else's race too heavily or doing too much responding to what they're doing, you find yourself in a situation where you might make mistakes that they're making and not know it until it's too late. And then you've dug yourself into a hole as well. So it sounds like you're thinking about it in the right way. I think with this kind of brings me to a topic I wanted to ask you about, which is another data piece that came out. I believe it was Liam, who is Aid Station Fireball on social media, is always got some sort of like data figure from races. And he was sharing just the distribution of pacing that you had at Black Canyon and then also what Rachel Drake had. And the similarities between the two of you were that there was a very evenly paced race, as far as we can tell. It's tough with a course like Black Canyon because obviously you have, it's a harder course in the second half. So like an evenly paced effort is going to produce a positive split. But your positive split from 50K to 50K was only like, I think 15 minutes or something like that. So it's like when you weigh in the fact that the first, like, what is it? 19, just past 19 miles is mostly downhill. And then you get some nice climbs at the end. That's probably about as close to even as we've seen on a course like Black Canyon. And I'm curious about that. Was that intentional in terms of, were you like paying attention to certain things to know like, okay, this is how far or how fast I can go early on without it costing me at the end so that I am able to be strong in those later stages of the race? Or is it more just how that kind of played out?
Yeah. Like I had a time goal and I had a range, you know, of what I felt like I needed to be within. And I wrote that time down on my pace bags or my crew bags, sorry, my crew bags. So my crew knew exactly where I was. And I would check and you know, I wasn't paying attention to my watch really that much. I was just kind of racing and running how I knew that I needed to and focusing on just kind of the things I needed to focus on, like fueling, hydration, like running within myself, different things like that. But I did kind of have an idea. Like I felt like I could have hit 7 hours and 20 minutes. That was my goal time for the race. And that was based off of the training I'd done and everything else. And I'd run this race previously in 2020, of course, and I won it in 2020. So I had experience on the course. And I knew that the second half of the course was the hardest part of the course. That last 40K is where the race is won or lost pretty much every year. And so I knew that I needed to have legs for that last 40K. So that was the goal, was to run that last 40K. At a faster, harder effort than that first 60K. But it changed a little bit because people started pushing those downhills at the beginning so fast. I did back off a little bit just to make sure that I saved a little bit. So I was running at the top end of my splits, of my course record splits that I had set. But I knew that I was still in range and I knew that I'd be okay. And luckily, I think, you know, because of the fueling, because of maybe backing off a little bit here, backing off a little bit there, I was able to have a lot of that energy for that last 40K and run that very, very fast. That being said too, there were some course changes like in the weeks leading into the race. So the 720 was based off of last year's course, under ideal conditions, of course. And so I thought like, well, if the weather is similar to what, you know, Anthony ran last year, if it's the same exact course, like I can run 720, like that's where I felt like my fitness was between 720 and 730 is kind of where I had. But of course they changed the course a little bit, which actually ended up adding a mile to the course and it added an extra 800 feet of elevation gain. Plus we had to deal with the mud at the beginning of the race, which slowed us down just a little bit. So there were like, there's always going to be something like that that you have to mm-hmm. encounter. So you have to take that into account. But honestly, if I would have ran the exact same course and had the conditions we had, which was similar, a little bit cooler actually temperatures than they had last year, I think I could have ran right on that 720. I would have been right at 720 on the course that was a mile less with 800 feet less elevation gain. So it was really actually cool for me to experience that because it shows that I'm judging my fitness correctly, which was awesome. And it also showed me that I executed exactly how I thought I was going to. And that shows me that I'm racing within myself. I'm racing smart. And I because and like you said, because I ran such an even race, like it shows me that I'm distributing that energy correctly, and I was able to run exactly how I thought I wanted to. So it was, it was very cool in that way that I was able to execute like that, and that was the plan, was to execute exactly like that.
Awesome. I wanted to ask a little bit about just obviously Black Canyon Western States are more home courses for those of us living in the United States, but you've done a lot of racing, as you've mentioned, internationally. And a lot of times that kind of comes with all of the logistical stuff of traveling, long flights in certain circumstances, maybe actually moving to another country for a time period to get ready and adjust to that. You're not just a single guy who's bouncing around from spot to spot whenever you want. You're married. Your wife Ashley loves to run ultra marathons as well, and you have two kids. What is it like traveling internationally? I know you bring your family with you from time to time. What goes into the decision-making process between like, hey, I'm going to go do this race solo versus bring the family? Or is that even a question? Have you just decided, hey, the family's coming, this is the way it is?
Yeah, when possible, I want to bring my family with me every time because that's where I feel most balanced is when my wife and my kids are around me. And my thought is like, hey, I go out and I execute training every day. I have great workouts, great long runs, at home with my family, my kids, I go for a long run and then I'm a dad, the rest of the night. And then I wake up the next morning, I do the same thing. Like, what's the difference, on race day? Like, it's the same concept, right? For the most part. And so it's like, why not just keep everything as simple and, like the same as possible? And so that's what I have focused on. That being said, my son has recently started school, so we are having to stay home a little bit more, which is probably not a bad thing. So we've actually set it up to where my most important races are June and August, Western States, and then one of the UTMB races. This year it'll be CCC. So Western States, CCC are my most important races. The most important blocks for those races are in the winter and in the spring, And so the thought process now has been, let's stay home, winter, spring, get the most important blocks done at home where we can be, in a comfortable environment and execute exactly how we need to, get as fit as possible. And then in the summer, we're going to go spend, a short period of time in France in a place called Tignes, which is at altitude, to prepare for CCC. And then if we want to do some traveling as a family, do some vacations and whatnot, we'll do that in the fall, during my off season, maybe during some, maybe pick a race or something that's maybe not as competitive or high intense as something like Western States or CCC. So yeah, that's kind of where we're at now is we are balancing it a bit more because in the past we might have got ourselves in trouble a bit, like traveling too much. Traveling's hard on the body. You're not able to get the training exactly how you want to get it in because you don't have all the amenities that you would have at home. So now it's like, let's half the year focus, stay balanced, stay home, do exactly what we need to do to prepare, and then we can travel a little bit more in the fall. So that's what we'll do now. And I think it's the important thing with all this, and it's been brought up a lot on this podcast is balance. Whatever you feel like gives you balance and wherever you feel most comfortable and excited and just at ease is probably the best place to be for your training, for your racing, for anything that you're wanting to do. And I think that we've kind of found that now after years of trying different things out. And yeah, I'm just really excited for the future. I feel like my best years are ahead of me, to be honest with you.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you're setting yourself up very well to be able to execute for years to come. And I think just like from following you, I know how much of a emphasis you put on your role as a father and a husband too. So when you're doing these things, I know that's not something that's just in the back of your mind, but it's a primary decision-making thing. And, you know, when I think of like my years as a teacher, the students I had that had the opportunities to travel more, for whatever reason it happened to be, usually it was their parents were involved in something that required travel, or they were just very interested in travel in general. They just had such a unique experience that I think was such a benefit to their ability to kind of succeed in the world of education. So like, yeah, I could totally see you thinking of it through that same lens where it's like, here, here's some of the opportunities that I have as a professional athlete that if I bring my family with me, now my children are going to get exposed to a whole bunch of things they maybe wouldn't otherwise, learn how to navigate different areas of the world, see different things, and just grow as people in a way where I'm sure when they're adults and they think back on what things were the most impactful in their youth, in their mind, there's going to be some of these trips that you've taken them on.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my goal the whole time, is to bring my wife and my kids along with me to so they can experience the world as well. You know, we've made some incredible friends. We've had some amazing cultural experiences around the world that the kids wouldn't have otherwise. You know, they've been exposed to so many different foods, different, you know, religions, cultures, people, and it's just been awesome for them to experience that. And I want them to have those same opportunities that I have, because, you know, I think it's a bit unfair for me to go experience all this and them not to, you know, have at least a little bit of a taste of it. And yeah, there's a time and a place for it, but we tend to work it out the best way we can. Luckily, I have an amazing wife who actually is a teacher. And so even when we're like abroad or doing stuff, she's able to kind of keep the kids in a good routine and rhythm and educate them. And she just loves being a mom. And she's very supportive of me and my career. And it's just really awesome to have her, you know, by my side throughout all this. And that's what we are. We're partners, and we're trying to be the best parents we can. And that's what I focus on, is I try to be the best athlete when I need to be the best athlete, try to be the best husband when I need to be the best husband, and the best father when I need to be the best father, and try and balance that as much as possible. I'm not perfect, but I'm trying my best, and I think that's what really matters.
Mm-hmm. Is Ashley teaching full-time at the moment?
No. She took a break from teaching when we had our kids, you know, to be a mom. Luckily, where we live here in Cedar, we're set up pretty well for that, for her to be able to take a break and not have to work a full-time job. She does do some race directing. She actually throws on a couple races here in Cedar City and does some other things. But yeah, she's a mom right now. And then she'll probably go back to doing some teaching later on, you know, as the kids get older. But yeah, it's been awesome to have her to be able to really take care of the kids and you know, be the mom, I guess, that they deserve.
Yeah, no, it just sounds like from following your career, just the relationship you and Ashley have in terms of supporting one another is just really fun to watch. Because I know, like, you know, the sport is young still, and being a professional athlete within it is really, really new, to be fair, if it's going to be kind of a primary income side of things. So like early in your career, there's risks that are taken when you decide I'm going to go this path. And, you know, I'm sure like the conversations you and Ashley have had with one another are always, were always around like, you know, what is the relative risk here? Is this something that I should do? And being able to trust your partner in those decisions and know that you have their support is really something that I think probably makes things sustainable.
Yeah, for sure. And if it wasn't for Ashley, I wouldn't be in the situation I am now, because at the beginning of my career, I was working full time. I was managing a running store in St. George Running Center. And Ashley was working full time as a teacher. And really, we were living off of her income, because I wasn't making a ton at the St. George Running Center. I was making a little bit, but we definitely needed two incomes to survive. And honestly, like, you know, it wasn't till about 4, maybe 5 years ago that I was fortunate enough to become a full-time professional, you know, runner or athlete. I mean, I do have a coaching business as well that I run. So I do that as well on the side, but I, for the most part, I'm a full-time, you know, athlete, which is awesome to have that support, you know, from my sponsors. I mean, you know, in particular, Hoka has done so much for me that I can't thank them enough for, you know, providing the funds for me to be able to do this as a full-time athlete, but all they've done, you know, outside of the funds as well, you know, as a company and the support that they gave me, you know, after my knee surgery, they could have just let me go and been like, hey, you know, we don't ever know if you're going to come back from this, but no, they supported me through the entire thing, signed me to a new contract, not knowing, you know, what I would be able to do, recently. And so it's been really cool to have Hoka, and I'm really love Hoka. I love running for Hoka. I love the product, and they've made this all possible, you know, between Ashley helping me early on in my career, you know, having to work full time to now being able to be in the situation I am now because of Hoka, Koros, different sponsors like that. It's pretty special. It's pretty awesome. It's a dream come true, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you just about kind of a little bit. I don't think you have to get into your history of running necessarily, but you were a very good competitive runner in the standard distance stuff before you became an ultra marathon runner. Was it something where, like, when you were in high school and in college, you were thinking, I want to take a swing at maybe becoming a pro runner at Olympic distance stuff at any point on the roads or the track?
100%. Yeah. That was the goal. Actually, I knew about trail running and ultra, of course, because I had been working at the St. George Running Center since I was like 15, 16 years old. And there, of course, had some ultra guys coming in and out of the store. And a lot of them would talk about Western States, Hard Rock, you know, these races that they really wanted to target and go after. And I started researching those races, you know, from that, you know, I'd hear them talk about it in the store, and then I'd go online and watch videos about it and whatnot. And I was like, oh yeah, someday I'd love to do ultra running. And I remember like running with my collegiate teammates, and we'd do on these long runs, and I just really excelled at long runs. Like the longer the run, the better I got. And like, we'd get to the end of long runs, especially hard long runs, and nobody could stay with me on the team. And it was this kind of like, man, I loved it. Like I loved going long, and I loved those opportunities to really just, run for long periods of time. And, my collegiate teammates would be like, you know, we can see you being like an ultra runner someday. And I'd be like, yeah, yeah, maybe someday when I get older, like, you know, when I'm like 40, 50 years old, maybe I'll run it. But I want to do like marathoning, and I want to like try and chase an Olympic team for like the 10K and stuff like that. And my biggest goal was the marathon. Like after college, I thought, I'm going to go into marathoning. I'm going to try and make the Olympic trials. I'm going to try and make the Olympic team. But then, yeah, I got kind of coaxed into signing up for the U.S. Mountain Running Champs and then Speed Goat. You know, people have heard that story, and
yeah,
just kind of went from there. Like I fell in love because I was like, wow, I can run a marathon, or I can run even longer than a marathon, and I can do it in the mountains and on the trails. Because like I grew up like hunting, and I grew up fishing, and I grew up camping and hiking long distances with my dad across the Uinta Mountains and different places like that. So I loved the trails, but I didn't realize that you could kind of bring them both together. And it was still very competitive. And when I got into the ultra scene and I saw that, oh man, I can bring both these together and marriage them, it was like, sign me up, man. Like, this is what I want to do. This was what I was made for.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, because I think it's just an interesting piece to the sport of ultra running right now is, and you probably see this as a coach yourself, I see it with coaching clients that come to me now, where they're coming from such a different range of backgrounds, where, you know, I've got some clients now where it's like their background is backcountry hunting, and it's like they want to be ready to go and, you know, pack an elk or whatever happens to be out from deep inside the backcountry. And that doesn't come from sitting on the couch. So they're interested in this stuff. And I think we've got guys like probably Cam Haynes to credit for a lot of the awareness around this sport and how it can be used as a vehicle to that lifestyle as well. But
I mean, that was my introduction to ultra running. I grew up hunting with my dad when I was tiny, like a little guy. And like hunting is like a religion here in Southern Utah. Everybody hunts. And so like, I grew up doing that, you know, we'd go out and get an elk or a deer every year, and then we'd eat on that elk the entire year. And it was clean, good meat that we were eating that entire year, you know? And like, we'd go out for like the whole entire day and we wouldn't eat anything, like maybe have a granola bar the entire day. And we'd just move through the mountains. Like, And then if we actually killed something, we'd have to pack it out. And so like it was like, but I loved those days. Like I looked forward to hunting season every single year. And I still continue to do it, you know, with my dad today. Like we hunt every fall and it's something I look forward to. And it's a way that I can feed my family. You know, like recently I've really focused on increasing my protein intakes, which has been key for me, like really trying to hit higher and higher protein numbers, which is helping me with recovery and a bunch of other things. And as I go and I hunt, you know, and kill an elk or a deer, you know, that helps me in that. And so it all works together. It's kind of funny how it all kind of started with that. And now it's continuing to, you know, provide for me and help me with my career. And it's just kind of, that's, I guess that's kind of where the roots all started, was from doing that with my dad. And I still really enjoy it to this day.
Yeah. So is elk hunting kind of the primary hunting season that you target, or is it, I know you mentioned deer. What are the hunting seasons you typically try to get out
primarily
for?
Elk. We like elk meat a lot more. Like it's tastier, it's better. And like where we live, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of elk. And so it, like, we love hunting elk, and we bow hunt. We do archery. We don't rifle hunt, which it's a lot harder to archery hunt and to bow hunt. But it's also a lot more challenging, and it's a lot, just, I think it's a little bit more fair for the animals as well. But we just really love the archery side of it. And we really, enjoy doing that every year, but yeah, it's mostly elk, but you know, we do some deer hunting as well sometimes.
Cool. Yeah. I had Brian Beckstead on not too long ago, and he's a big fan of ultra fly fishing, as you probably know. And he was telling me about stories of, like, you know, having a setup where he can pack it down really small in terms of getting a fly fishing rod out into the mountains. And then you get these unpressured lakes where he's pulling fish out on command, essentially. And, yeah, it's fun to hear the story.
Yeah, we've done that as well. We do a fly fishing trip most years, me and my dad, and that's super fun as well. We'll go to Alaska and catch a bunch of salmon. And then it's like, you just fill the freezer with like fresh caught salmon, fresh, you know, hunted elk. And it's like, it's perfect for the family. And it, you know, it really aids in training and everything else as well.
Yeah. Get fit and save a little on the grocery bill.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. Hayden. One more thing I just wanted to ask you about before I let you go is, I know you're a fan of Kobe Bryant, and I know you're a fan of kind of just sports in general. So when I think of Kobe Bryant, I think of I think it was an interview he did where he was talking about just the way he viewed kind of preparing for an NBA season. And he said that, like, he looked at the protocol of the NBA player when he got into the league, and he noticed that they had certain, like, kind of structures where at a certain time, I think it was like from 10 a.m. to noon, it was like they practice basketball. Then they would have like an hour of meetings. They would have like strength and conditioning. And it was kind of just the setup with like X number of hours per day. And he realized, oh, there's this like big gap in the day where they're not making us do anything. And he started running the numbers. He's like, well, if I fill that gap with 2 hours, 3 hours of extra work every day for the first 5 years of my career, at that point, no one will be able to catch up to me because I'll have banked so much training and additional practice that if someone decides, hey, I got to catch up, it'll be too late because I'll already be off and running. And I thought that was a really interesting view of things. So do you have anything that you think about in kind of similar light with ultra running where you're like, all right, in the off season, I am going to implement this, or I'm going to try this, or maybe it's something that's not in the off season, just in general that you think about as like, I'm going to do this because I think other people probably won't, and it's going to give me an advantage.
Yeah, for sure. I think the biggest one, so recently I've been kind of listening to some podcasts and different people talking, and they've mentioned something about like recovery, right? Like the importance of recovery. And a lot of people say like, oh, I just don't have the time. Like, you know, I come home from work or I do this or I do that, I don't have the time to like implement proper recovery. Like, If I was a professional athlete and I didn't have a full-time job, like I could do the recovery. And it's like, no, I don't think that's the case. Like how easy is it, like before you go to bed, to do an hour of recovery? You know, whether that be some form of like activation, strength work, it could be rolling, it could be like the compression recovery boots, it could be anything like that. And I would say, yeah, that's kind of been the big thing for me, especially coming off this knee surgery, is usually an hour, 30 minutes to an hour before every run, I'm doing some form of strength training, activation, something like that. And then an hour after each run, I'm doing some form of recovery, or the hour before bed, I'm doing some form of recovery. So in essence, if you look at that, say I run twice a day, and then I have my little bit of recovery at night, I'm getting an extra 3 to 4 hours of recovery, activation, strength training in every day that a lot of people probably aren't getting in. You know, that's on top of the running and cycling that I'm doing. And I don't count all those. I count a little bit of that in my Strava and on my training, but I don't count all of that, you know, hours that I put in with those little things. And I think those make it possible for me to have really good days every single day. They help me recover and they help me be activated and ready to go to have my best workout or my best session every single day. So I'm getting quality in every day. So I would say like that's kind of my thing, is like, and that's been a more recent thing, is focusing a lot more on recovery and focusing a lot more on strength training. Like Kobe said, you know, seeing those times when maybe I could just be like hanging out, you know, on my phone looking at Instagram, and instead taking that time to go do something useful for my training, like activation or recovery. So it's putting the phone down and utilizing the time that I'm given every day to put in just a little extra work, even if it's an extra 30 minutes or an hour or whatever it is every day.
Awesome. No, that's great. Before I let you go, Hayden, if you want to just share with the listeners where they can find you, website, social media, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So you can follow me on Instagram. It's Hawks_Hayden on there. That's pretty much the most active I am is on Instagram. You can also follow me on Strava. So I do put all my training up on Strava. Strava is my favorite social media app, to be honest with you. So like Strava and Instagram are the places to best find me and to see what I'm up to.
Awesome. Well, I hope all the listeners go and follow you on Instagram, follow you on Strava, and check out, is it hawksrunning.com? Is that your website?
Yep. Hawksrunning.com.
Perfect. Well, Hayden, thanks a bunch for taking some time to chat. I'll be rooting for you at Western States this year, and I hope you have a great time preparing for it, as I'm sure you will.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on.
Hey everyone, if you are here, you have stuck around to hear more about how I use the products that sponsor the Human Performance Outliers podcast. I have taken a lot of time identifying these products and brands, and I'm incredibly grateful that they are both products that I'm able to use sometimes on a daily basis, and they also are interested in supporting what I'm doing here at the Human Performance Outliers podcast and want to work with me. So here's how I use them. One of the reasons I came across S-Fuels originally is it maps my protocol perfectly. So at S-Fuels, they follow a principle of right fuel at the right time. This means that they don't demonize carbohydrate, but they understand the power of a low carbohydrate diet. So throughout my year, I have ranging inputs between fats and carbohydrates, but they're always based in a foundation of fats. S-Fuels approach matches that just right. It allows you to build a foundation in your nutrition with fats, but also gives you options to pull that powerful lever that is carbohydrate when you need it. So in their product line, this is how I use it. Race Plus, that's their carbohydrate source. I'll use this for faster workouts or for races when I'm trying to defend muscle and liver glycogen. Train is their fat-based powder, which is basically a sports drink powder, but with fat instead of carbohydrate. Helps improve fat oxidation rates. I love it for workouts where I need some calories. I don't want to run a huge deficit, but I don't want to introduce carbohydrates. Side note, this actually makes a great high-fat smoothie as well. So if you're interested in that, check out my Instagram reels. I've got some smoothies on there that I've used this for. Revival is a protein powder that I will use post-workout and post-race a lot of times. This is something I can easily mix into something like full-fat yogurt or in that high-fat smoothie that I mentioned. Using this just makes sure I'm getting off on the right foot with the recovery process and maximizing my protein muscle synthesis. Next is Primed. Primed is my go-to caffeine source when working out. It gives you 80 milligrams of caffeine, but they make it in a way where it will help with focus, won't have jitters, and can help you with the fat oxidation benefits of caffeine consumption, as well as the reduction in perceived effort. Life bars are my go-to snack. If I'm doing a pretty big training block and I need something between meals, Life bars give me some healthy fats and protein that'll fit right into that. Finally, Keto 3. Keto 3 is a product that I'll use basically to replace anything I would have used granola for in the past. So I keep a bag of this around and I can sprinkle that on top of things that I would have previously put granola on when I want to keep the fats and the proteins high and the carbohydrates low. If you want to learn more about these products or check them out, head over to sfuelsgolonger.com where you can get 15% off your order. And this year, stay tuned because I'm going to be doing a series of free sample pack offers from those products that I just talked about. Last year, some of my trail running friends told me I needed to check out this brand named Jonji. And when it came time to update my running apparel, I thought, okay, I'm going to check these guys out. I'm stoked that they want to work with me because I've ended up using this stuff for way more things than I actually thought I would. My main focus when I'm picking out workout gear, and specifically running gear, is how does it actually like sit on my body while I'm going through the different mechanics that are important to running or strength work and things like that. So the more a product can function the way it's supposed to, but stay out of the way, the better, as far as I'm concerned. So they're kind of lightweight, breathable, moisture wicking type of setup works really well for me. They're shorts, they're AFO middle short. I actually got two pairs of these and I find myself using this for everything basically. Like I've used them for short intervals, I've used them for long intervals, taking them out for long runs, easy runs. I even go to the gym with them. So I need both those pairs. I've been going through them. They have an odor resistant tack to it too. So I can usually get a few workouts out of them before I need to wash them. And I just find like my range of motion is great in it, regardless of whether I'm doing those short intervals, long run in the gym, doing mobility routine type stuff or like muscular endurance strength stuff and all sorts of different activities. So that short is going to be in my rotation even when the temperature picks up. I got a couple long sleeve options too from them. There's the Repeat Merino long sleeve and the Rover Merino hoodie. So the Repeat Merino I've been using as kind of like either a base layer if it's really cold out that I'll put on first and then something else over it. Or if it's just kind of chilly where like a t-shirt or a singlet isn't quite enough and I may want it for part of the run but not all the run, or maybe I want it for the whole run but I don't want too much so I feel like I'm sweating profusely underneath that, this is perfect for that. So I'll use it over the singlet or just straight up first layer on and then something over top of it. The Rover Merino hoodie is one of the things that I'll use as kind of an outer layer. I'll put this over that Merino long sleeve. And this one has a few extra features to it. It's a little thicker, so I can get away with it in a little cooler weather. But it also has like a hood that you can put up and then a face mask that covers part of your face that you can use too if it gets especially chilly out there. I've been using this both for the running workouts as well as taking it to the gym from a transportation standpoint as I'm getting there. And then during my warmups and things like that as something I can kind of count on. Both these items are super light and packable too. So if I do have a scenario where I think I might need them for part of the workout but not all of it, I don't hesitate to bring it because I know I can take it off and store it pretty easily if I need to without having to worry about feeling like I've got this like extra thing coming with me that is getting annoying. The next item I got from there was the tights. Now, tights are products that I am very skeptical about usually because I always end up having this situation occur where they either feel like too tight and restrictive or they feel like they're sagging on me. So I'm either feeling restricted by them, or if I don't feel restricted, I feel like I'm constantly trying to pull them back up or find a way to like fit them on me so they don't sag down. And it's just this constant battle where I just usually avoid wearing tights if I have to. These ones are much different than that. I'm loving these. I'm wearing these on all the cold weather days where I want that full protection layer, and they sit on me so perfectly. I can even stuff stuff in the side pockets. They've got these side pockets on either side. I put my phone in there. I've even taken my outer layer off and rolled it up and stuffed it in that side pocket. I don't feel like it's creating a situation where it's getting in the way or causing it to sag. Also, full range of motion. I've used this for faster runs and slower runs, and that's usually my test. If I can do a speed workout in the short, in the tights, then that's great because that means I'm moving through my gait cycle smoothly. And if they're not sagging on top of it, that's a bonus. I also picked up their Atlas Multi Pant, which is a little bit more robust than the tights. So if you're looking for something for more of an outer layer, a little warmer, this would maybe be a little bit of an option. I've been using it on colder days for running and just as a way to wear something warm to get to the gym or during my warm-up during that. I love these because they taper down really nicely, so I'm not catching it on the side of my shoe as I'm going through my gait cycle or a movement in the gym. But they also have these really long zippers on the side, so if I do want to peel them off or put them on, I don't have to take my shoes off or feel like I'm fumbling around with it a lot. They also pack. They pack up real nicely too, so you can roll them up into the back pocket, and then if I do find that I'm taking them off partway through a workout, I don't feel like I have this like extra piece of gear that's like bogging me down much. If you're interested in checking out John G., you can get a 10% discount. Use promo code BITTER10, that's BITTER10, and go to janji.com, that's JANJI.com. And if you do like to shop at REI, they are also available there. Element Electrolytes has been my electrolyte of choice for quite some time now. They're actually back sponsoring the podcast for the third year. It's how long I've been using them. I actually got my sweat test done last summer where I found out that I lose 614 milligrams of electrolytes for every liter of fluid that I lose. And it's not uncommon that I'll lose a liter plus of fluid per hour, especially when it gets a little bit warmer. So I'm usually using electrolytes in my workouts, especially as they go beyond an hour or if the temperatures are a little bit warmer or if I'm just going through a lot of fluids for one reason or the other. My protocol right now is I'll do a half a pack of one of their chocolate flavors in my coffee in the morning before my morning training session. And then I'll do another half a pack to a full pack of usually watermelon in my fluids that I'm taking on during and after that workout. Their product specifically has 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, and 60 milligrams of magnesium. So you can go a long way with one packet. Some of the other flavors they have available are citrus, watermelon, orange, grapefruit, raspberry, chocolate, mango chili, chocolate caramel. They actually right now just rolled out their seasonal options. One reason to keep an eye on Element is they will do seasonal releases where they have limited time offers. And right now their seasonal option is chocolate mint, chocolate chai, and chocolate raspberry. If you check them out and you like that sort of idea of mixing something with your tea or coffee or your hot chocolate, if you want to make yourself some hot chocolate with this, you can do that. Definitely check out the mint and the chocolate raspberry. I love both of those. If you do want to try them out, you can actually get a free sample pack right now with your first purchase. You just have to go to drinklmnt.com/HPO. Put in that /HPO and that'll offer up that free sample pack, as well as let them know that you're a supporter of the Human Performance Outliers podcast. Delta G Ketones is a product I've been using for just over a year now. I started using them early last year as a test to see if it was something I was going to want to use in my training and racing. I wanted to stress test them in something longer, so I actually used them at the Rocky Raccoon 100 as my first kind of test of will these handle for the duration of a 100-miler versus just what I would notice in kind of day-to-day workouts and things like that. And they are something that I'm going to keep in my routine. So my basic go-to is the Delta G Performance. The reason I chose Delta G over all the other exogenous ketone supplements out there is they have a formula and a dosage that is supported by the research that we have to date. So they are the company that got the DARPA funding to design for special forces. They've been 50 plus published studies, 20 plus ongoing studies. My protocol with them is just to take a single bottle of that Delta G Performance before a key workout or before a race. And if I'm going to be doing a race that spans longer than 3 hours, I will take another bottle every 3 hours while I'm out there. So if you're interested in more details about exogenous ketones and Delta G specifically, I would encourage you to check out episode 351, Exogenous Ketones and Performance with Brian McMahon. You can also, right now on their website, they understand that this is something that is new for people and they want to make sure that you are using it right and that you know what you're doing. So you can do a free consultation with them if you go to their website at deltagketones.com. If you do decide, hey, I want to check this stuff out and see what my experience is like, you can get 20% off and let them know you support HPO by using promo code BITTER20. That's BITTER20 for 20% off at deltagketones.com. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Human Performance Outliers podcast with Zach Bitter.